You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the founder of Hope Fridge, a free community pantry in Neenah, joins the show to share their vision for the new project. Now, there's been a lot of attention lately on the way we teach social studies in school, especially around issues of race and politics and history, and about civics education more generally. According to one new study, Wisconsin could be doing a lot better in that civics category. The report from the Thomas Fordham Institute, a national think tank focused on education policy, looked at the standards for K-12 civics and history education in every state. Wisconsin gets an F. Wisconsin requires 3 years of social studies and a civics test for high school students to graduate, but not a standalone civics course. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you remember about your education in civics and history through your school career? Do you feel like it covered what it needed, or are there things left out or glossed over? If you're an educator yourself, how have you put your curriculum together for those topics? Should there be a state mandate for a civics high school class? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. David Griffith is a senior research and policy associate at the Fordham Institute. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, David, what does a state need to do to grab an A on your report card on civics education?
Well, it's a great question, and there's a lot that I could say, but I think the biggest thing it can do is to spell out much more clearly exactly what kids need to know in both civics and U.S. history. Right now, if you actually read the standards, you'll see that it's very unclear, and basically it's tough to detect any sort of scope or sequence in U.S. history at all.
How do we stack up compared to other states? What are other states doing in their guidelines that gives those kind of more specific requirements you're looking for?
Yeah, well, Wisconsin is hardly alone. We gave 20 states an inadequate rating. I think I'm not breaking new ground by saying that the United States in general has a huge problem when it comes to civics and U.S. history education. We've focused on everything except this. But we did find five jurisdictions that we thought did a very exemplary job of laying out what schools should teach in these two subjects. And those jurisdictions were Alabama, Tennessee, California, Massachusetts, and the District of Columbia. So some blue states and some red states. Basically, as we see it, kids should be making at least two full passes through U.S. history, one in lower grades and then a second in higher grades at a more advanced level. And then in addition to that, we really feel like civics is something that should be embedded basically in every grade, K-8, and then required in high school. You know, these are topics that are really are or should be at the center of the mission of public education. So it's sort of absurd that we're having this conversation, but something needs to change.
Well, now here in Wisconsin, as I understand it, something like 3/4 of districts require, for example, a high school civics class. The idea, I think, being that, okay, we're going to leave it to some local control. Local districts are going to set their own civic standards, and we respect them enough to know that they're going to do a good job. What would you say to that argument?
Yeah, well, the first thing I'd say is that civics and U.S. history are for everybody. 3/4 is good, but all is even better. So, you know, in my view, there really is not a good counterargument against the notion that these subjects should be required. It's almost hard to make the case for why kids should know U.S. history. It's so obvious. I guess the second point that I would make is that in practice, districts and schools and teachers will, of course, always have a great deal of discretion, particularly at the classroom level. Teachers simply do have some discretion. But I think there's really a lot of value in setting out a very clear vision at the state level of what's expected, what every kid should really know and be able to do in these two subjects to be prepared for informed citizenship. And so that's the basic message of the report, which is, again, civics, the state of state civics and U.S. history standards in 2021. These are topics that everyone deserves access to.
And David, as we wrap up, what do you think we lose if kids aren't coming out of high school with a solid grounding, especially on the civic side of things?
Well, I mean, I think pretty much everyone agrees that we're in trouble as a country. Democrats and Republicans aren't getting along. But one thing that we ought to be able to agree on is that we should be having an informed debate. People need to know how their government works. They need to know the history of this country. If they know those things, then they may find that they are able to agree disagreeably. But if they don't know these things, then they're really not able to engage with the system in an informed way. They're not able to be informed voters. They're not able to be informed citizens. So it's just fundamental to inform citizenship, to understand how your government works and how your country works. And so it's something that every district and school should really be focused on.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That's David Griffith, Senior Research and Policy Associate with the education policy think tank, the Fordham Institute. That group's recent report says many states, including Wisconsin, should have clearer requirements for civics and history education. Now we'll take a closer look at how these subjects are taught here in Wisconsin. Diana Hess is Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education. She's the author of the books Controversy in the Classroom, The Democratic Power of Discussion, and Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. She's also taught high school social studies. Diana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the rules about civics education and what we have to do in the state?
So the state requires all students to take 3 years of social studies in high school, and it doesn't spell out what courses schools should offer. But as a factual matter, we believe that every high school in Wisconsin is offering a U.S. history class, and we've recently analyzed the data here at UW-Madison, and we've learned that about 75% of the school districts in Wisconsin require at least a one semester course in civics for high school students.
What do you think of the idea of a state mandated civics course spelling out some of the specifics of what should be taught?
I'm a big fan of a state mandated civics course. I agree with what David just said, that even though 75% is good, 100% would be much better. And it's long concerned me that Wisconsin is one of the relatively few states that doesn't require all students to take a civics course.
And what kind of things do you want to see taught in the class? What a quick laundry list, I guess, Diana, of the sort of things you want to see in that class.
Well, I think in a required civics class, there needs to be a lot of focus on understanding how the government works and what doesn't work about how the government works. There needs to be a huge emphasis on the contemporary political issues of the day. One of the things we know from research is that understanding contemporary political issues is quite important because it not only helps students learn really significant content, but it also helps engaging them in seeing themselves as members of the political system and as people who need to take a big role on the political stage. So a lot of what we're trying to do in civics is to teach important content in a highly interactive way. We're also trying to teach skills and dispositions. We want students to come out of a civics class believing that it is their responsibility to be engaged in the political system.
That's an interesting point, because I can imagine a really boring civics class. And I think some people in American history don't have to imagine it. They may have lived through a really boring civics classes where you get, you know, the skeleton, the framework of American government and how a bill becomes a law and things like that. Why is it important to have that more interesting and more engaging approach to it with how it fits into current events?
Well, first, it is more interesting and engaging because it's authentic. You know, what we want to teach students is how to be engaged in the political system and how to understand the political system well enough that they have the confidence to be engaged. We know, for example, that a lot of people who decide not to vote, when asked, why aren't you voting? They say they simply don't know enough to feel like they understand the issues of the day. So we want to make sure that we give students lots of opportunities to learn about the issues of the day. And by doing so, they're learning how to learn because, of course, the issues of the day are going to change over time. But the expectation that they be engaged in the political system themselves is not going to change. And we know from lots of research, especially lots of research that's been done here in Wisconsin, that there are teachers who are just exceptionally good at developing curriculum and developing lessons and units that are about contemporary political issues, that are focused on helping young people learn how to make up their own mind about what they believe about these issues. And that in the process of doing so, they're just learning an awful lot of really important content.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Fitchburg. Susan, hi.
Hi. I'm a retired teacher, although I was not a history teacher. But I do feel it's very important that there be standards for what is taught and for what students should know about history and civics. You know, we put a lot of pressure on students to know all the rules of the road for their driver's license. And I think it's more, even more important to know all the things they need to know to be voting citizens. So, and I think it is very important that it be interesting, because I can remember back in my high school days that my history class was not interesting. So I really think there need to be some standards for what students need to know, and it needs to be impressed upon them how important this is.
Susan, thanks a lot for that call. Diana, the rules of the road for American citizenship, in effect. What do you think of that analogy?
I think that's just a great analogy. You know, we want students to understand enough about history of the United States and enough about how the political system works to feel like they really want to participate. And we know that people are more likely to participate if they have deeper understanding. We also know that what students do in school really does matter. There's been a lot of research linking high quality civic education in schools to students' political and civic engagement when they leave high school. But one thing I think we need to make sure to not forget is that civics and history should not start in high school. As a matter of fact, one of the things I really appreciated about the Fordham Report is they talked about the importance of having a lot of history and civics starting in kindergarten and going all the way through elementary and middle school. And so I think we know a lot about what really high quality history and civics looks like in elementary and middle school. Unfortunately, we also know that for a variety of reasons, students are less likely to get enough civics and history in elementary and middle school as they did in the past.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Diana Hess, Dean of UW-Madison School of Education, about civics education standards here in the state. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. In your own school experience, do you think your civics and history education covered what it needed, or were there things left out or glossed over? If you're a teacher yourself, how have you put your curriculum together on these topics? Do you think the state needs civics education guidelines, specific ones, maybe even a mandated high school civics class? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Diana Hess, Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education. We're looking at civics education in Wisconsin's K-12 schools, what's required, what it's for, what we need. Call 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts or experiences to share. Let's go back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Afternoon. Thanks, Rob. I come at it from an educator's perspective myself. I'm retired, but I've seen firsthand how teachers basically have their hands tied when it comes to talking about issues not unlike what you are now. One hot button topic is healthcare, or more importantly, the denial of access to healthcare for so many young people. For example, in this state, the politicians won't expand Medicaid. How does a teacher get past that without looking for trouble? Honestly, getting called into the principal's office, actually.
Jim, thanks for the call. And that's got to be a big worry for teachers and principals and school boards, Diana. If we're talking about controversial issues in the classroom, are we going to end up going viral or having parents yelling at the school board meeting?
Well, we really want teachers to help young people understand contemporary controversial issues. And that's not considered out of the mainstream of high quality civics. As a matter of fact, about 20 years ago, there was a report issued called the Civic Mission of the Schools. It was a bipartisan report signed on to by hundreds of organizations. And one of the six recommendations for what constitutes great civics is to make sure that young people are learning about controversial issues. So I think it's extremely important that that be part of the curriculum, that principals support teachers when they're teaching about controversial issues, and that we do a lot of talking with parents about why they should want their children to learn about controversial issues in the schools. I think what parents are often afraid of is that they misinterpret the teaching of controversial issues as the indoctrination into a specific perspective on a controversial issue. And good civics teachers are not interested in students forming a particular point of view on a controversial issue. They're interested in helping students learn how to analyze the issue, learn multiple and competing views, and come to their own mind about the right answer. And I think we know that there are lots and lots of teachers across the United States, and especially here in Wisconsin, who are exceptionally good at doing this. And so I think it is really important for us to say we need controversial issues in the classroom, and we need to work hard to make sure that teachers understand how to teach those in a way that is fair-minded.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Dan now in Hurley. Dan, hi.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Next year will be my 38th year of teaching. I'm retired in Michigan, but I teach in Wisconsin. You know, in many ways, there's less freedom in education now than there used to be. And I agree with the previous caller and what your guest is saying, that the debate is essential. Like the Founding Fathers did in the summer of 1787, the going back and forth and getting the issues out there is much better than trying to hold up conversations at the administrative level. And I think Michigan used to have the 18 core democratic values, and Wisconsin does the civics test. But I think more is better, and there's such a ripe age of instruction right now, given January 6th and given Joe Biden now in the White House. It'd be great to discuss them. Thank you.
Dan, thanks for the call. Diana, what do you think of what Dan had to say?
I totally agree with Dan. I mean, this country was founded on deliberation and debate, and it is, you know, absolutely essential in a democracy. I mean, if you don't have deliberation and debate, you do not have a democracy. And we have to teach people how to do that. And the best way of teaching people how to do that is by making sure they're well-grounded in constitutional understanding. We want young people to learn a lot about the Constitution, and we want young people to learn a lot about contemporary and controversial issues. And if that learning is done through deliberation and discussion and inquiry, we know it's going to be both more engaging and it's more likely to stick. You know, one of the things we know is that if you're memorizing just a whole bunch of disconnected facts, that's not really going to develop the deep kind of understanding that people need in order to make the kinds of decisions that people need to make when they're living in a democracy. Civics is hard, and it should be hard, but it doesn't mean it needs to be boring. It should be hard and engaging.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about civics education in Wisconsin. Diana Hess is with us, Dean of UW-Madison School of Education. Back to your calls now with Heather on the line in Madison. Heather, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to say I was agreeing with your other guests and callers, and I felt like it's really important, one, for us to have standards to make sure that we are getting equal teaching across the board, but two, to make sure that that happens throughout our academic career, not just as small children or in high school, but both. And about the engagement part, I remember as a kid in kindergarten, we had a mock election, and I'm going to date myself here because it was Carter versus Ford. And in our election, Ford won, but of course, in the real election, that didn't happen. And our teacher used that as a way to engage us as students and talk about how the government works and that kind of thing. And then when I was in high school, we had a great civics teacher. And at the time, Sandra Day O'Connor had just been appointed to the Supreme Court, being the first woman. And so that was something that he used to engage us in that conversation. And
Breaking up there, Heather, but I think we take the point. Diana, it sounds like pretty good uses of current events circa 1976 into the 80s.
Absolutely. I think it's really important to have simulations, and that's, of course, what a mock election is. You know, we've got a great example here in Middleton at the high school where all students are required to participate in a legislative simulation where they actually take on the role of legislators, and they develop the bills that they want to deliberate. It's really exciting. And one of the forms of civic education that I really have been impressed by, because it puts students in the driver's seat, but it's really rigorous and really hard. When you talk to students who have been through that course, you know, they talk about how hard they worked, but how interesting it was and how much they learned and why they think they'll continue to participate once they leave high school because of the effect of that course.
Thanks for that call. Just a little bit of time left. We've got a caller on the line, Diana, wondering how much we can integrate local civics, local government level civics education into schools. Can you take a minute to share your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one reason why you want to be careful that you have enough flexibility in standards that you can incorporate a lot about local government. Because, you know, in many ways, local governments are the ones that have a huge effect on our day-to-day living. And so we want to make sure that young people are learning about local government, that they're not just learning about state or national or federal government. And I think that, you know, teachers who do that really well are in some ways few and far between. It's hard to teach about local government because most curriculum, for example, is not written about local government. But I do think it's really, really important.
Diana, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's Diana Hess, Dean of the School of Education at UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about social studies and civics education in Wisconsin's K-12 schools. Earlier, we heard from David Griffith of the Fordham Institute after its national report gave Wisconsin a failing grade on statewide standards for civics and history curriculums. Coming up, a project in Neenah aims to reduce food waste and help feed people in need. We'll open up the new Hope Fridge. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we want to hear from you about your favorite vacation memories. Maybe you discovered a cool restaurant that you want to share or a great trail on a camping trip. Maybe you fell in love. We'll take your calls coming up at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Now, a new project offers groceries to people in need at no cost, no questions asked. Hope Fridge is a community pantry in Neenah. People are free to come take the food they need at any time, no paperwork or qualifications necessary. Hope Fridge recently announced a second location upcoming in Oshkosh. TJ Hobbs is founder and director of Hope Fridge. TJ, welcome to Central Time.
Rob, thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
How did you get the idea for this project?
Honestly, I want to make sure it's clear. Community fridges are not new, but they're new, at least in my experience, in this area, as someone who grew up here. So the community fridges that I saw all over last year popping up all across the country, the main one that inspired Hope Fridge was Love Your Black Community out of Portland, Oregon, that my friend Kai Delgado Warren started on her property, just on her front lawn. And it received so many folks just visiting to it, getting so much help from that one fridge that you could tell that every other city that saw fridges like, how do I do this? These fridges, they've been popping up all over. They've been thriving. I knew from growing up here that if I had had something like this when I was here, growing up as a kid and as a young adult, it would have gotten used by myself and folks like me. And I just think, you know, Kai and the Love Fridge in Chicago as well was huge. They have about 70 community fridges thriving in Chicago. It's beautiful to see.
Well, let's take it a step at a time. How does the food get in the fridge?
Sure. Multiple ways. The main way is folks just go shopping for the fridge like they would a friend or neighbor in need. And we're so thankful for that. We do set up some guidelines for safety. And every community fridge is a little bit different in how they do that. Some are plant-based and plant-only fridges. Ours is more of kind of like a hybrid where we ask folks please to not bring raw meat for safety purposes, but we still accept like cooked meats in prepared meals. We try to be as grab and go as possible so that folks, you know, who might not have a kitchen can still enjoy some meals that have been pre-cooked, that have been purchased by their friends and family and neighbors. And when I say friends, I mean friends they might not have even met yet.
Can you paint us a picture? In my imagination, there's a refrigerator on the roadside with a really long extension cord. What do I actually see if I look at the Hope Fridge?
Sure. So the Hope Fridge, it's a funny story. We originally had that in mind. We're like, we'll just do a long extension cord to the sidewalk. And, you know, as we learn as we go, as we do with any project. So the city of Neenah informed us that there was a ordinance for 25 feet back from the sidewalk was what a structure would need to be placed. So that partnered with us just thinking long term. And the homeowners, Marika and Danae and Neenah, have been absolutely fantastic with how willing they've been to roll with just the changes that have been happening. And as we've gone, we've learned about these ordinances. What we ended up doing was we put in an electrical, like underground line with an electrician so that this fridge will stay powered through the winter. And I learned from talking to the Chicago area, which obviously has similar winters to us, that out of all their 70 plus stations for community fridges, they've only had to replace one or two throughout the winter. And one of them wasn't even due to getting too cold. It was just due to it being a glass door that broke. But these fridges are more resilient than we give them credit for. I think it's going to make it through the winter just fine. But we also have a community of folks willing to step up and donate their fridges if they have spares, if we ever need a spare fridge, which, again, people are naturally connective. They're naturally generous. They want to give to projects like this. And all we're trying to do is just channel that positive energy into an outlet that can help folks who need it the most.
What's been the response to Hope Fridge so far in Neenah, both on the donation side and on the people using the food?
Yeah, definitely. So folks have stepped up to donate from all over the country. Like some people who don't even live here have given donations, which is fantastic. And then local folks have, you know, volunteered not only their donations, but we have been so thankful for folks who have stepped up to keep the fridge clean and maintained. We've now changed our structure from just a morning and a PM shift to 5 manager shifts per day. And all a fridge manager does is visit for about 15 minutes, you know, bring some cleaner or some Clorox wipes, whatever's your favorite preferred clean method of keeping a fridge clean, and just clean it as though you're cleaning your own fridge at home. Or better than that, if you're like me and you barely ever clean your home fridge.
I was going to say.
You know? Exactly. But yeah, folks have really stepped up. And we one day had like 2 volunteers for all of July. We made a post on the Facebook page about, hey, can folks, you know, if you have 15 minutes, step up and sign up for a slot to help keep this thing open. And by the end of that, by the next day, we had all of July filled with volunteers. That has since changed. We are still looking for July volunteers and now August because we've opened it from 2 to 5 slots per day. But that's just in an effort to keep it safer for the community, because the more times we check on the thermometer in that fridge, the safer it is for the community. And that's another important role of that fridge manager. It's a quick little 15-minute volunteer spot, but it keeps it clean. It keeps you know, food organized and make sure that it's not expired. And we don't accept open food. We don't want folks giving things they wouldn't give their friend or family. So, you know, please don't use it as a dumping ground for your expired food. And thankfully, most people haven't been doing that. But that's another part of the role of the fridge manager, is just to make sure that it's presented at all times.
And why was it important to have a food pantry that, you know, they didn't have any limits, require any kind of applications or paperwork?
Right. So important to have that. I, you know, have been very fortunate in my life to only need help a number of times from pantries, but I have needed that help. And when I needed it, I remember, and I've heard from folks who have needed it and who need it still, how it feels so the humiliation and the degradation that can occur from folks walking into places where they're inherently going to be having a conversation with another human being about things like, oh, why do you need this? What did you, you know, and there's folks might not say it out loud, but there's always that underlying idea of like, well, what did you do to get in this position to have to need the help that you need? That is not how life works. And that folks who are trying the hardest are often the people who need the most help. It has nothing to do with, you know, there are systems in place bigger than any of us. And this Hope Fridge project, hopes to catch the people, you know, and lift up people who need the help the most that might not feel comfortable going to, you know, for example, pantries that make you pray before you're able to take a box of food home. I mean, we are purposefully unaffiliated with religion at Hope Fridge, and it's just for that reason. It's we're thankful for those folks who are doing, you know, great work through religious organizations, but not everybody feels comfortable going to a church to pick up food. And that's honestly in the Fox Valley, you know, that's a majority of the resources we have. There are some other resources as well, but I remember when I needed help that they had limited hours, and I was often working because I needed the money and I was struggling. So it was hard for me to afford, or rather find the time to go to the food pantry because I was too busy working. So I wouldn't have to go to the food pantry. Like, I'm not the only one who's been stuck in that cycle. And I just hope, you know, how nice would it be for folks who work second or third shift to get off at 1 a.m. and if they really need or want some food to know that there's a place that they can go even if everywhere else is closed.
As we wrap up, TJ, if somebody is listening in another community wants to start something like this, how would you suggest they get started?
Yeah, there are so many ways to get started and get involved. What we did was as simple as, well, first of all, I want you to believe that you can do it because you can do it. And the minute you do what we did, which was just ask for help, you will get people who want to help. You will. Just put out that question, be like, hey, who's willing to host a community fridge site? We went residential, but I mean, ideally, I'm learning that a business is more of an ideal location, not only for, you know, where it's located, but the number of folks you can reach. Like the location in Neenah is fantastic, but it's a little bit more suburban than we would have hoped. But we are so thankful for them because they allowed other businesses to look at what we've done and say, wow, that can really be a functioning thing. Sometimes, however you need to get started, that's step one. And then just know it, when you put out that energy in the world and say, I want to do this, people will step up and they want to help. We're inherently generous folks. All people are. And you can build a fridge in your town by reaching out for help and knowing the resources will come to you. We've made a Facebook post. That was step one. We just asked for help. Step two, we asked for builders. We got volunteer builders, Molly and Brian from downtown Oshkosh. Bowen Streets Repeats, they volunteered to help us lay brick. We had people donate brick. We had, you know, the wood we had to buy and some gravel we had to buy. But the rest of it, you know, we've just had folks coming in from all sides saying, how can I be a part of this? And that will happen to you if you just put out that energy. It might take longer than it took for us. It might not take as long as it took for us. It took us about 3 to 6 months to get the whole thing up and running. But just take the leap. Go for it.
TJ, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was TJ Hobbs, founder and director of the Hope Fridge Project in Neenah. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. This month marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, here's Wisconsin Life host Maureen McCollum sharing a story from a couple years back about a Milwaukee garden. Peter Bryant, WPR program director for the NPR News and Music Network, says it's his pick for his favorite Wisconsin Life story.
There's a garden on the north side of Milwaukee where young farmers are learning to grow their own fruits, vegetables, and herbs. But it doesn't stop there. These budding entrepreneurs are also selling their produce.
Hey, young farmers, over here for a second.
I got a strawberry.
I want us to go through the garden, identify what's ready to get harvested. Other than that, we're going to do some business as usual. We need to do some weeding, some watering. I do have some seeds.
I am Alexander Hagler. I'm with Groundwork Milwaukee as a young farmers program leader.
And I'm Nick DeMarsh, also with Groundwork Milwaukee.
Right now we're at Sherman Park Garden, and this garden started 2 years ago under the hospice of Nick. It's definitely to get young people involved in our food system and just kind of like training them to be agents of change in their own communities.
I got you. I'll take you on the tour. This is our bed where our tomatoes, huh? And this is collard greens, I think. Amir Washington. I'm 12 years old and I'm going to 7th grade. First thing you want to work on is pulling the weeds out.
Yeah, pulling the weeds out. My name is Anijah Howard. I'm 12 years old. The first thing that we actually come for is the strawberries. Like, especially when they're little because they're like, nice and sweet.
I like to grow the strawberries because they're good and the jalapenos. My mom has a mini farm. Like potatoes, some peppers, and tomatoes. My name, Cozine, but they call me Coco, Batty. I'm going to the 8th grade. I'm finna water the plants.
You want to go refill?
Mm-hmm.
You know what?
Come on. I like to plant, I like to give back, like, growing them and then give it to homeless people and stuff.
Oh, this is getting heavy.
We're really trying to get them to adopt healthy habits early on in life. So thinking about where their food comes from, the act of gardening as a physical activity, trying to get them to be physically active early on so that they can have these skills for their whole lives.
So what do you guys see that's ready?
These right here, these things, these
not strawberries yet.
Yep, what do you call those?
The radishes. That's right.
Twist and then pull.
And the other thing would just be simply being comfortable in the garden, so not freaking out about bugs.
This our sunflower seed. We built this so it can attract bees. I don't know if they went, but once it pollinate, it make our flowers better. So we try to put more flowers in there instead of putting like more lettuce.
What I like most, I like watering the plants because I like seeing them grow more, and it helps me realize how much farmers do for us.
Yep.
Michaela Corman. 13 years old.
We did let folks know that the farm stand is open, so if folks come, we can open that up. In fact, you already see we got a chalkboard, so we're going to put farm stand. I want us to go
there. It says farm stand. We have basil, lettuce, radishes, collard greens, beets, chocolate mint, green tomatoes, plus low prices.
It should be like under $4. Keep it cheap.
We're actually, I was going to ask them about what you guys think of the pay what you can. You know, some people, it's like whatever you have in your pocket. Some people might have a couple bucks, and they'll just give you that.
You got your first customer. Ooh, right? You got a customer.
Okay. What you want?
What do you guys have? I heard you have some tomatoes.
Everything's under $4.
Everything's under $4.
So how many sticks of chocolate mint?
I think I'll take three or four. Oh, wow, that's beautiful. I'll definitely buy that one.
So the tomatoes are two, and chocolate mint is like $2.
I like to think that I'm just planting little bugs in their ear, little seeds, and that, you know, as they grow older, they'll start to better understand these things.
Those were some of the young farmers and staff of Groundwork Milwaukee, which operates a handful of educational gardens throughout the Milwaukee area. Curious how you can find their produce?
Next Thursday, you should come at Mary Ryan Boys and Girls Club of Greater Milwaukee and support our farm stand.
And they're under $4.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, vacations are good for relaxing and exploring, and a great vacation can create some awesome memories. And we want to hear from you. We'll take your calls at 800-642-1234 about your best vacation memories, big or small. Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Hope to hear from you coming up next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6, it's 1A+. Millions of Americans are quitting their jobs. The reasons why will likely shape our economy for years to come. So what's behind the so-called Great Resignation? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, summer is a good time for vacations, and vacations are a good way to make memories with friends and family. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Share a favorite vacation memory with us. Maybe something here in Wisconsin, maybe on the other side of the world. Have you ever gotten lost on the road but found a cool destination along the way? Do you have a memorable road trip experience to share? Where have you traveled that you recommend to everyone? Maybe you found that restaurant off the beaten path. Whatever leaps to your mind when you hear about a great vacation memory, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We asked around here at WPR, as we do from time to time. We heard from Kathy Miner, music library volunteer. Kathy says, I returned home from Yosemite with three purple toenails on one foot and two on the other, the result of hiking mountain trails in two small hiking boots. Got tired of people asking what happened to my toes, so I went to the drugstore and found some purple nail polish and painted my remaining toes. End of nosy questions. It's the only time in my life I've ever worn, Kathy says, polish on my toenails. I always wonder if Max Factor has any idea that one of their hues is an exact match for bruises. Yeah, some of the best vacation memories aren't always when things go smoothly. It can be the things that went wrong. How about you? 800-642-1234. Call in with a favorite vacation memory that you'd like to share. 800-642-1234. Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez says, when I was growing up, every year a bunch of my aunts and uncles and cousins would go down to Southern California and stay at this hotel by the beach. One year when I was an awkward teenager, I met a boy who was also staying there and developed a small crush on him. Hung out in the arcade one time, and that whole weekend whenever I walked in the room, my aunts and uncles would start singing the "I've Had the Time of My Life" song from Dirty Dancing. It was very embarrassing, but memorable. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with your vacation memories. Lisa starts us off in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. About 5 years ago, we were in Greece, and we went on a little small sailing excursion for $100 in that day. We went had fresh fish that was cooked in a cave on the rocks in the cave. We got to point out where the Venus de Milo originally came from by the man taking us on the excursion, the beautiful water, the arches. It was just the most unbelievable experience, and going back at sunset, and we will never, ever forget that.
Wow.
Just amazing.
And Lisa, had you been a sailing person before this? Was this your first time in a big small boat sailing excursion?
It was my first time,
wow.
And I was a little bit nervous,
yeah.
But it was just, you know, and we had people from all over the world. We sat around those rocks and drank a little bit of wine, and why were you there, and what brought you there, and just a beautiful, beautiful experience.
That sounds like a great memory. Hungry for some seafood now. Lisa, thank you so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234, asking you to share a favorite vacation memory at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to Brent now in Milwaukee. Brent, hi.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. What's your story, Brent?
Well, I had a road trip years ago on the way to a vacation, and it was so interesting it caused me to write a little radio drama script. And it's called The Road 2, as in The Road 2, T-O, The Road 2, T-W-O, and The Road T-O-O, meaning that road could have its own personality or an alternate universe. Because really, when you're looking at a map, you have no idea who wrote that map. They could literally be leading you into the bowels of hell, for all that matters. Or sometimes you've been driving so many hours, the road takes on its own personality, starts doing crazy stuff in front of you. So at some point, I'll finish the script and get it on your radio station.
All right, yeah, mail it in. Have your people call our people, Brent. It didn't take you to hell, though. I mean, you're still with us.
We're still with you.
Excellent. Brent, otherwise that would have been a really spooky call. Brent, thanks a lot for sharing that. I love that idea of just the mystery of where is this road going to take me. Thank you so much, Brent, for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Looking for your road trip memories, your vacation memories, your favorite ones. Let's go to Gary now in Milwaukee. Gary, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story for us, Gary?
Well, first and the only time I took my wife camping, we were at Devil's Lake State Park, and then we did some of the rock climbing and stuff like that on the, you know, where you can climb and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I sprained my foot so badly, she basically had to carry me down.
Uh-oh.
And then she got me down to the bottom, and then she went ahead and got the car and came back and picked me up, but I just remember that because her idea of camping from that point on was a 5-star hotel.
Wow, Gary, thanks. Thanks so much for sharing. I had a similar experience with my wife at Wild Loosing. Not as bad as being up on one of the high bluffs at Devil's Lake, though. We did get to visit the Prairie du Chien Hospital, though. So that was an interesting experience. Gary, thank you, and respect to the people. They did great work there. Thanks a lot for the call, Gary. Time for one more. Kimberly is with us in Waupun. Kimberly, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a few experiences, but one of my favorites was going swimming with the sharks in Cabo San Lucas last November and getting to see the whales, the moms with their children. It was beautiful.
And it wasn't scary swimming with the sharks, Kimberly?
Yeah, no, we didn't get to swim with the sharks because we followed the whales.
Okay.
And then by the time we went fishing for the sharks, it got too late. So I never got to go in with the sharks. But
okay.
Yeah, it was a wonderful, just a wonderful experience.
Awesome. Kimberly, thank you so much for sharing that. Thanks to everyone who shared a favorite vacation memory. You can keep it going. Email ideas at WPR.org. If I get some more stories, I can read them later in the week. Again, that's ideas at WPR.org.